Concerts will start here in a minute. Dominic and Forsman. Okay. And then you'll read in for. There's also Hobbes. Can somebody? Got some. You got a whole page. You got a whole, you got a page and a half. They got nothing. You have the most. So, counselors, can you? I'll have Counselor Anderson. You can read the other two. So, Counselor Anderson, you'll do President Forsman and Counselor Conner. Good evening, folks, counselors, city staff, meeting members out in the wide world. We'll get this agenda session started. So I do want to just make mention that there is a public hearing approving a tax increment financing plan for the Residence Apartments Tax Increment Financing District as proposed by the Housing and Redevelopment Authority of Duluth, Minnesota, and that will be on Monday. So the next item would be item number 4 under my committee and finance. It is resolution 786, resolution distributing the estimated 2023 hotel, motel, and food and beverage tourism tax. And I'll just note that there is another motion to amend. Pause. Does others want to speak to it? Or yes, all set.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. I am going to have to ask Rebecca here, or Attorney St. George, what is it that we would do in the situation that I have an amendment and then I'm making a motion to amend the amendment?
Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Elstead, you don't need to make a motion to pass the First Amendment. So the second amendment that you submitted, like, that would just die.
Okay.
If no motion is made for it. So the second one would be the amendment that you're asking for.
So what I will do is read in the statement of purpose for my new amendment that will be coming forward. That also includes Vice President Kennedy and Councillor Randorf. So the purpose of this motion is to amend, is to provide $20,000 for the Clean and Safe Team in Lincoln Park Craft District, $20,000 for the Lake Superior and Mississippi Railroad Company, and an additional $20,000 for the Gary New Duluth Skateboard Park for a total of $40,000. This additional funding will be taken from the operational contingency. The remaining operational contingency will be $40,000. I'll yield if anyone wants to.
Okay. Counselors, any questions? Councillor Allo.
Thank you. Kennedy, I had a question for administration regarding the operational contingency. If administration can speak to what that allocation of funds was for and how it would be impacted, given that we are taking from that, the new amendment calls for taking from that fund.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Allo. The operational contingency is money that we use throughout the year when there is either a change to the dollar amount for something that we've previously committed to. So an example would be fireworks for this past summer went from, I believe, $50,000 to $75,000. And we had to find that money effectively because we did not have that operational contingency for 2022. We had to find that money through operations, taking that money out of city operations. And occasionally there are items that come up that have a short-term turnaround that we are in need of being able to make that decision to directly impact a tourism item. And so our ask for that, our recommendation for that $100,000 is based on past history and what we believe is necessary. And so the administration's recommendation stands, and I would not be supportive of taking money out of that, but I also acknowledge that the council is making amendments and choices based on what you believe is the right choice.
I had a follow-up question, but I'll wait for Councilor Anderson.
Councilor Anderson.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Mr. Shuckman, as tourism tax comes in through the year, we often see adjustments. We recognize that more is coming in or less is coming in than we have budgeted for. In the event that more money is coming in, does that money sort of get automatically thrown into that contingency?
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Anderson, no, that money is for next year. So money comes in over the course of this year, and that is what we're allocating for next year.
So at this point, it will be that we would, if this amendment were to pass on Monday, then we would have $40,000 in the contingency fund for the year 2023.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Anderson, that's correct.
Great, thank you.
If I may ask, I have a question. Director Carlson or somebody from finance, what happens to the last few months of the tourism tax funding? And maybe you had stated that, Mr. Shuckman, and I missed it.
Vice President Kennedy, if you would be willing, could you just be more clear on what the question is?
So we're spending tourism tax money up to this year, and the month would be October or September, correct? So October, November, December, I may not have the months right. Where did you say that funding would go?
Vice President Kennedy, that funding, the funding for all of 2022 is what the council approved last fall at this time. So that money then is allocated. As money comes in throughout the year, we budget for a projected amount. And so if that money comes in at the end of this year and is over that projected amount, then that is money that would go into reserves or would be something that we would have available when we get to this conversation for next year.
So I would still be interested, what was the projection then? Was there an overage or a underage? I'll get those names right someday.
Vice President Kennedy, I'm going to see if our budget manager, Ms. Casper, can answer that question. I'm not sure that I have that information.
Vice President Kennedy, so for this year, we're projecting $12.4 million. And so at this point, we are trending high, but we still have 4 months to go because we haven't received this is through July. And so we still have 4 months. So we don't know what will happen in between now and then. And so we prefer to stay at the 12.4 just because we have to meet our debt payments as well. So we want to have, you know, some wiggle room in there.
Good question, but let me pause for a minute. You may sit if you like. I had it on the tip of my tongue and I was going to write it down. Councilors, did you have any other? Well, I guess it came back to me. What is the history of this contingency? Do we typically have $100,000 in there every year? Maybe if there's some history, because I'm guessing councilors are thinking about what is the potential of something happening and we don't have that money now. But sometimes history is the predictor. But I also think about now where people are wanting to still be outdoors a lot more because we're still recovering from COVID. So I feel comfortable with what we've put forward, but I'll yield.
Vice President Kennedy, Ms. Casper may have that history available. If not, we can get that to councilors. This year, in the time that I have been here, is the first time that we have not had that contingency available. And so we have had to make some adaptations, which is, as I said, has actually been something that we've had to take out of city operations. And so that is not an ideal scenario for us. as we try to balance those two things. And so I'll see if Ms. Casper has that history that she may.
Vice President Kennedy, so going back to 2018, we had 4.7 budgeted for contingencies. 2019, 215,000, which we went over by 170,000. 2020, we were budgeted at 97,000. However, that was the year that everything crashed, and so we didn't touch that because we had to pull back on our tourism funding because of COVID.
Could I ask you to open your crystal ball and just sort of think about what do you think would happen? Would we be in a bad spot if we move forward with this resolution?
Vice President Kennedy, I would say that what we put forward was what staff was comfortable with. I can tell you that we had to find over $20,000 out of general operations for the fireworks this year. And that came from different departments' budgets.
Thank you. I see Councillor Owl.
Vice President Kennedy, I had a question for with the contingency, with the funds that weren't used during that year. Essentially, what happens to the leftover funds? Does it roll over to the next year, or what has historically happened? And if there's any funds left in that contingency, where does that funds go?
Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Owl, that money does roll over. We also do maintain the appropriate fund balance in reserves to make sure that should we have to pay debt in a emergency situation, that we're prepared for that. We don't dip into that money. That money that does roll over is factored into the recommendations that we make. And so you'll note, if you look at it, we're overspending the amount that is estimated for revenue. So we're already dipping into that kind of that rollover money. And that is part of why, again, that we have included that contingency, is to allow us to have some flexibility throughout the year.
Have you completed, Councillor Anderson?
Vice President Kennedy. Mr. Shuckman, the Duluth Airport Denver flight did not use its $50,000 from last year. We don't know if it's going to be utilized this year at this point. They had asked for $50,000. If the additional $50,000 stands, then they have $100,000 in reserve. Is that any portion of that money available to be utilized as contingency money in the event that they are not using it?
Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Anderson, by the end of the year they had not used it, we would potentially be able to do that. I did speak with Duluth Airport Authority Director Tom Werner today about this, and they continue to work to implement that Denver flight. And the money that we have set aside out of tourism tax is a significant portion of what they have, with the package they have to put together to get an airline to come to Duluth from Denver. And Mr. Werner can speak for this himself and would be happy to talk with you. He was clear about that with me today. They continue that work, and the money that we have committed is for marketing to bring, to let people in the Denver region know that they have a direct flight to Duluth, and also certainly to let Duluthians know that they can use the airport here to go right to Denver. That is something that they were hoping to have active early in 2021. The pandemic obviously has impacted that, and Mr. Werner was very clear that they are working that very hard and working to bring an airline in soon. And so I would not recommend counting on that money, because our goal and their goal is to have that in play as quickly as possible, because it will mean having that flight in place and having people be able to move directly from Duluth to Denver and vice versa.
So I hear that, and I understand the importance of marketing for a new flight like that. But I guess, and I would be I'll just say this. If a new flight has not been secured, a new carrier has not been secured by the end of 2023, I would hope that we wouldn't be looking at them adding that another 50,000. So it's this package just keeps growing and sitting this pot of money there.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Anderson, it is not an annual allocation. It was a cumulative 100,000 that the city made a commitment to, and that's the total.
That $100,000 is a number that was previously discussed. I don't recall that myself. But.
Correct. Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Anderson, that is something we, with respect, have talked about both of the last 2 years as we have done these allocations. And it was, with that in mind, that we have made that commitment, knowing that that is an expenditure that is really crucial to showing that Duluth broadly as a community is supportive of this flight to Denver, and that we are willing to effectively put a package together that would lure an airport to bring a flight here, because we need to prove to them, rather than the other way around, that there is value for them in doing that.
Well, thank you. If I may, Vice President Kennedy, just I want to, with all due respect to Budget Manager Casper and staff, I really like this amendment, and I appreciate the efforts of the co-sponsors to come up with a solution. That does several things without debilitating any one organization. And I'm going to count, in the end, if things get tough somewhere, we'll count on our staff and council, of course, to work together to find a solution. So I'm quite comfortable with this and look forward to hoping to see it pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Anderson. Councilor Randorf.
Thank you, Vice President. My voice was shot with laryngitis. My question is, we know we've heard, we've used that. First of all, I want to thank staff for thinking of having a contingency fund that's smart. And I know we've used it for fireworks. My question is, if something would come up during the year that one of the tourism allocations needed it, wouldn't our answer just be no if we didn't have funds available? Like, what would be a situation where we'd have to say yes and take it from another fund source?
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Randorf, that's a great question. Obviously, if we have no money, then the answer is no. One of the reasons we ask for that contingency and we recommend that contingency is to allow us to be flexible throughout the year. One of the examples, and I see you'll see on this on Councilor Alstead's amendment that the recommendation that we have put in place for the UMD NCAA Women's Hockey the Frozen Four is. That is something that we hear from the university somewhat regularly. There's a track and field championship that is coming, and what happens is I will hear from the athletic director that they need a commitment of $15,000 for a bid to bring several thousand people here, and they have to know that they have that money in hand. And so that is where we are able to flex that money during the year on a very short-term notice to say, yes, we have that. Yes, we're willing to help with that, because it is money that we can literally invest in a future tourism tax return that they can point to, direct attendance numbers to hotel numbers, to things like that. So that's one example of one of the ways that we use that money, is for that type of quick, we have this opportunity, we're going to miss it. And yes, to your point, if we did not have the money, we would just have to say we're not able to help with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Randorf. Any other councilors? Huffman, your number
just
one is up.
Briefly, but it is worth noting, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the amendment and the intent of it. I will just note, along the lines of Councilor Anderson's question, that the Lake Superior and Mississippi Railroad Company has not used the $20,000 that was allocated to them for this year, or maybe it's even for last year, but that money has not been used. And so, if you're having this conversation about used money being used or not used, I think it is worth noting that as we're planning to add more money to their tax allocations.
I don't really have a question, and I'm not sure, because I would love to respond to that, because they did reach out to me. So the Mississippi Railroad did reach out to me, and they let me know, and they had questions about why they were not chosen. They also let me know that they still have costs, even though there's no train there. There's still gravel, and there's still road, and it still needs to be maintained. And that's what they're going to be using this for. If we do not help them, by the time we're ready to put back the tracks, there's nowhere to put it. So that's what they're using it for. And $20,000, and I run a couple nonprofits, is not that much money. I would say if we're having questions about contingency, I might want to go back to the Denver flight. But that was not a question, but I'll yield there. Councillor Randor, or Councillor Anderson, I believe, was first.
Vice President Kennedy, I see Mr. Bueller is here, and I wonder if Mr. Bueller might be able to provide any information about the LSNM, or is that outside of your
purview? He's here for NLX, if I may help out.
I know that. He's here for many things.
And Lake Superior, I'm not sure if Lake Superior folks are here, but you may just have a train question, is what you're saying.
Well, just, you know, so that is there somebody else here from the railroad?
I believe they were maybe going to come
Fulton,
on Monday.
Mr. Fulton, you can answer that?
I will just say I'm not necessarily questioning that allocation. I don't have any specific objection to it, but I want to just note that if we're going to have that conversation, that we need to do that fairly and consistently.
All right, I will yield. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Vice President Kennedy. I'm curious as to why I didn't realize they did not spend last year's. So that does make me pause. So if we can get that answer.
I don't believe they got any money. They received any funding last year.
Vice President Kennedy, they received 2022. They didn't get any. They haven't been dispersed yet. Sorry. In 2021, they weren't allocated any money. In 2020, they were originally allocated $20,000, but it was pulled back with COVID.
How much were they allocated this year?
2022,
$20,000. And they didn't spend it?
It has not been dispersed yet, so they have not requested or invoiced for it.
Correct. We need to find that out. There's their money right there.
Let's just pause for a minute. When you say it hasn't been dispersed, what does that mean?
I'm not sure how their particular contract works. In others, it's typically we receive an invoice from the organization saying we're ready for our disbursement.
Does that disbursement January 1 to December 31, 2022, they have to spend it or they have to give it back?
Vice President Kennedy, not necessarily, no. In typical years, it is within 1 year. However, similar to the Denver flight, that has rolled over.
Well, they could still spend it.
That's correct.
And sure. And I guess I would just back up a little bit and allow them to spend that money. 2022 isn't over. So I would not penalize them. It feels a little... I'll pass. Go ahead, Councillor Anderson.
Can we request to them, to LSNM, Ellis, got it all. Can we request that they let us know by Monday what their intentions are with the $20,000 that they have already allotted to them and the $20,000 that they are asking for this year?
Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Anderson, are you asking the administration to do that? We have recommended, I believe, not allocating money to them. So I'm not part of that conversation that's happening with them directly.
Also, Vice President Kennedy, would you be able to reach out to them? If they've reached back out to you, could you reach back to them and say that council is asking for some clarification?
I certainly could do that, Councillor Anderson, but you could also do that as well. I don't have any questions about why we're giving them the money. So I might prefer for you to have a conversation with them directly instead of me being the middleman. And then I will ask them to come to the city council meeting on Monday. But I would encourage councillors to call them directly if you have questions to them directly.
Because I already gave you the conversation that I had with them. I don't have anything more. What you want is from them, not from me.
Yes, thank you. I'll yield.
Councilor Randolph.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vice President Kennedy. I'll give Councilor Anderson a little bit of grace. Our names are on this. I feel like we didn't do our homework. They have money. Now we're asking for more money. I'm a little uncomfortable with this as well. I'll make the call, and we'll find out. They're asking for $20,000 more. They haven't spent their $20,000. That's infuriating to me. And so let's find out, because we're coming forward asking for money. We're pulling it out of our reserves. We're taking time to talk about it. They need to give us a solid answer on what's going on here. So I'll make the call.
Anyone else? Okay. We'll move on to item number 5, which is under my committee. It's Resolution 820, resolution providing the issuance, sale, and delivery of general obligation capital improvement bonds, Series 2022A, in the approximate principal amount of $1,700,000, establishing the terms and form thereof, creating a debt service fund, therefore, and providing for awarding the sale, therefore. That's a lot of language there. Councilor Randolph, do you have your hand up? Any questions, councilors? Item number 6 under my committee again, Resolution 821, resolution providing for the issuance, sale, and delivery of general obligation capital equipment notes, Series 2022B, in the approximate principal amount of $3,385,000, establishing the terms and form thereof, creating a debt service fund, therefore, and providing for awarding the sale thereof. Any questions? We'll move on to purchasing and licensing. You'll be reading in for Councilor Hobbs. Councilor Awa.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Item 7, Resolution 776. Resolution approving the temporary expansion of the on sale intoxicating liquor license of various licensees. Item 8, Resolution 777, resolution approving issuance of a temporary on sale intoxicating liquor license to various licensees.
Councilors, any questions? Go to Councilor Alstead, personnel, item number 9.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Item number 9, Resolution 829, a resolution confirming the appointment of members to the Duluth African Heritage Commission. Item number 10, Resolution 841, resolution establishing a board and commission realignment review committee. Item 11, Resolution 842, resolution confirming the reappointment of Bernice Pepper to the Duluth African Heritage Commission.
Mayo.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. I was just curious if Councillor Alstead or Kennedy, if you could give a little more context about the board and commission realignment review committee.
Go to you, Councillor Alstead, as personnel.
I would request CAO Shuckman to do a little brief overview, because he probably has the points in front of him.
Vice President Kennedy, thank you, Councillor Alstead. Councillor Mayo, to your question, the city has, I think it's 34 boards and commissions, and that is a form of community engagement that we are very supportive of. We also have a real struggle with staffing all of those boards and commissions, and a real struggle with finding people to sit on them because of the number of just the sheer quantity of people. I'm trying to find here the numbers. Minneapolis, by comparison, I believe has 40 boards and commissions with nearly 5 times the population and 5 times the staff. And so part of what we are hoping to do with this resolution is look broadly at the number, look at ways in which it would make sense or be appropriate to make any changes to that. And there is no specific ask or specific outcome that we're looking for, other than to make sure that we're doing this in a thoughtful way that is appropriate for the community's ability to serve and the administration's ability to staff. Because right now, I don't believe that we are doing justice to the work that we're asking those boards and commissions to do just by virtue of struggling to fill them and struggling to staff them. And that is what we would like to have happen. So the Minneapolis has 42 boards and commissions. St. Paul has 33. And then when you get to a city more comparable in size, Rochester, which is still, I think, 30,000 residents more, has only 18. St. Cloud and Mankato, which are in the 50,000 resident range, have 19 and 5. And so we don't have a target number, but it does seem appropriate and like it's time to just take a moment, look at those, and better understand how we can serve the community in a way that's a little more effective.
And if any consolidation were to need to happen after the review, of course, do we assume that those terms would be fulfilled of the members that are sitting on these boards? Or I don't know what the legal standpoint would be on this, if there is a legal ramification, if we have to restructure our boards and commissions in any way as a result of this, if we appoint someone for a set term of 4 years, if they are supposed to serve out that four-year term then.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Mayo, I don't know that we have an answer to that. Attorney St. George certainly can chime in. The resolution itself specifically asks the committee to examine current boards and commissions, identify challenges and opportunities in recruitment, onboarding, and retention, identify duplicate duties, missions, and priorities, and then identify best practices, and then present a written report containing findings and recommendations to the council. So okay. That those things would come back through the council for discussion and for vote as appropriate. But the reality is that without that committee doing that work, I'm not sure that we're able to answer all those questions. And I'll at this point see if Attorney St. George wants to chime in on any of that.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Mayo, and also, I don't know that there's ever a requirement that we have to keep somebody on a commission ever. But I would have to look at the bylaws for the various commissions to know that for sure.
Yeah, I never realized we had 34 commissions. That's quite a large number.
It's a really heavy lift for the staff and for the community.
Thank you for the context, everyone.
Councilor Owl.
Vice President Kennedy, I'm really supportive of this resolution. Anything to alleviate stress from the staff, and also have more engaged, structured, or just more efficient community engagement. So I really like this resolution. To me, it's very similar to what we're doing with the Task Force Modernization, just really streamlining our processes. If there needs to be another co-sponsor, I would love to sign on to this. I noted that on the resolution itself, it says including two city councilors. Depending on who the Vice President Kennedy and Councilor Alstead, whether yourself or whoever you appoint, I would, if possible, I would love to be a part of that committee as well, or be a backup of some sorts.
Thank you, Councilor Owl. I would like to actually pull all three of these items, and I believe there's been a conversation of adding Councilor Owl as a co-signer. So we can move those off the consent, and maybe we can have some more discussion. The other two, I'd just like to welcome the African Heritage Commission members back and just make that, we can all maybe do a public statement of welcoming them. So. Any other councilors? We'll move on to item number 12. Councilor Randorf.
Hey. Item 12, Resolution 825, is a resolution approving a tax increment financing plan for the Resident Apartments Tax Increment Financing District as approved by the Housing and Redevelopment Authority of Duluth, Minnesota. Item 13, Resolution 832, is a resolution approving a 20-year development agreement between the City of Duluth and the Merge LLC for the residents at a total cost not to exceed $4 million. Item 14, Resolution 833 is a resolution vacating certain streets and an alley in the plat of Centerdale Addition to Duluth, reserving a utility easement over part of a 33-foot-wide unnamed platted right-of-way in said plat.
Thank you, Councilor Randorf. And I do believe item number 12 is connected to the public hearing that we'll be having on Monday. Is that correct? Thank you. Councilors, have any questions? We are on the next item, item number 15. Anderson, I believe you'll be reading in for President Forsman.
Vice President Kenny, one moment. All right, for President Forsman, Resolution 766, authorizing a multi-year agreement with Peterson Group LLC, Canary Consulting, for professional services related to the city's federal legislative program for a total amount not to exceed $91,000.
Mr. Mayo.
Just had a quick question for Mr. Shuckman or Mr. Gents. I know you're here as well on this item. Is this a group that we've been working with in the past and we're re-upping this contract, or are we going with someone new this year for this multi-year contract?
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Mayo, this is the group that we have been working with. We're in the middle of the second year, and when we started this contract, I don't know why, it's probably a choice that I made at the time, but we did not have it run through the end of this year. And so this contract is for the remainder of this year and then all of next year to avoid this issue in the future. They have, for the fairly minimal cost, already been involved in more than $1.2 million in federal funds coming to the city. And Mr. Jens can speak to that more in detail if you'd like, but they have been very effective. And we have been very happy with working with them, and so we're excited to continue that work.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Any other councilors? Move on to Councilor Mayo, Public Works and Utilities.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Resolution 23 is authorizing an agreement with St. Louis County for the 2023 6-inch wet reflective edge line pavement making project at various locations in the city of Duluth. Resolution 24 is authorizing a cooperative agreement with St. Louis County for the 2023 townships and cities maintenance striping program for road line striping at various locations in the city of Duluth at an estimated cost of $67,462. Resolution 826 is accepting a permanent easement for utility purposes from the Duluth Economic Development Authority over, under, and across real property in the Lincoln Park neighborhood for nominal consideration. Resolution 827 is accepting a permanent easement for utility purposes from Dirt Incorporated over, under, and across real property in the Duluth Heights neighborhood for nominal consideration. And Resolution 831 is accepting a permanent easement for street purposes from Dirt Incorporated over, under, and across real property in the Duluth Heights neighborhood for nominal consideration.
Questions? Anderson, I guess you do have resolutions. I don't know why I thought you didn't. So, Councilor Hall, you'll read the last one first.
Resolution 811, authorizing the acceptance of a grant from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety in the amount of $114,400 for the 2023 Towards Zero Deaths project, and further authorizing an agreement with the Lake Superior Traffic Enforcement Team Partner Agencies for services under the grant. And Resolution 819, authorizing the execution of a First Amendment to the agreement for services between St. Louis County and the City of Duluth for fiscal year 2019 Operation Stone Garden, providing for an additional allocation of funds to the city in the amount of $7,321 for law enforcement services under the grant from the U.S. Department of Public Safety.
Not seeing any hands. You were ready to read in, so we'll move on to the last item. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Item 23, Resolution 828, resolution authorizing approval and implementation of a Central Spaces Duluth Parks Recreation Open Space and Trails Plan. And if I may, I have just a quick follow-up question. I understand that this plan It's like kind of a decision-making guide for the next 5, 10 to 15 years. I was wondering if administration can just elaborate more on what the plan actually calls for, from besides what we can read on the resolution.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Owl, this is a this plan is it's a 10-year plan. It is the result of a tremendous amount of work led by our parks manager, Jessica Peterson, who I'll ask to come and provide you with that information. She's much better equipped to speak to it. But a staff, her staff, including Allison Brooks, Cliff Knettle, Katie Bennett, and Alicia Watts, all did a tremendous amount of heavy lifting. So I appreciate Ms. Peterson being here, and she'll be able to summarize that for you.
Thank you, and good evening, Vice President Kennedy and Councilor Owl. As CAO Shuckman said, this is about a year and a half long process in which we engaged with our community, with our Parks Commission, and many others along the way to develop a plan for how we'll chart our course forward for Duluth Parks and Rec. As you know, there are some things happening simultaneously that would impact the amount of resources available to us to implement on this plan as we move into the next decade. But in fact, our previous Parks Master Plan was completed in about 2010, 2011. And as plans do, it has a shelf life. And at this point, we're ready to bring forward a new plan and kind of reset our course for the future of Duluth Parks.
Thank you. One follow-up question. Where might the public be able to find that plan?
Sure. So all of the planning efforts that our Parks Department puts out are available on our website, so duluthmn.gov/parks. And then we list all of our past and current and in-progress planning efforts under the planning tab.
Okay. Thank you so much for all your efforts and your team's work on this.
Councilor Mayo.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Just a quick question about, I know all of us as councilors hear a lot about the community centers and how important they are to each of our communities. What does this plan offer in terms of those investments in the community centers across Duluth?
Thank you for the question, Councilor Mayo. The plan does call for us to complete a building plan, a building action plan. So rather than presume that at the start of this planning effort or conclude that with this planning effort calls upon us to proceed with an assessment specific to our building inventory, to look deeper at that as a subset of our park amenities, because there are so many and their deterioration is quite great. And the lift to bring them either up to par or replacement will be significant. And we feel it's worthy of its own effort outside of the plan itself.
All right, thank you.
Councilor Randorf.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Is the essential spaces plan, and thank you for coming and presenting, is this independent of the parks levy money? So this is all over here in this lane, parks levy's over here, right? Completely two different things.
Vice President Kennedy, Councilor Randorf, thank you for that question. It's an important clarification. As we move forward, the Essential Spaces Plan will continue to chart our course for what we do with our park system, how we program it, how we manage it, maintain it, etc. The plan calls upon us to look at the funding sources available to us, one of which is our park fund, which, as we all know, was passed in 2012. Is flat and does not increase with additional development and tax base. So concurrent to the master planning process, it's my understanding that there will be a referendum to explore the increase on that levy. That is not run by us as staff. We're simply providing the informational content to help voters understand the state of our system. The end of the Essential Spaces Plan lists a number of funding sources for us to explore over the next decade. One of those is, of course, to explore the value of the parks levy as it is today and what it could be in the future.
I think I understand your answer. Is it, this is more of a vision, and there's a vision for money, and that's one of the pieces. But this isn't a plan in place that you're needing that parks levy money in order to, you wouldn't have to modify this because this is a vision, right?
Thank you for the clarification. That is correct. This plan is not a budget.
Okay. It doesn't lay out dollars and cents, and it doesn't pre-allocate the dollars and cents.
Councilor Anderson.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. And thank you, Ms. Peterson. I mean, it's clear. So this document, if I recall, is 124 pages. So I know that all of my work with you and your staff over the years shows that you are nothing if not thorough and put everything that you have into your work. So I really respect that. My question is, and I don't have any intention of pulling this, but I, to be frank, I'm hoping to spend some more time with it over the weekend. And we're airing it out a little bit here tonight. What would the implications be to you and to the staff if for some reason we decided to pull this from the consent and table it for another meeting? Would there be implications to you at this point?
Thank you for the question, Councillor Anderson. So Vice President Kennedy, Councillor Anderson, at this point, the plan has passed a rigorous community engagement process. It has been presented twice to our Parks and Recreation Commission in August and in September. It has been put out for public comment for many weeks in a row, as well as been available for public hearing at any of our public meetings through Parks and Recreation Commission. It was passed by the Parks Commission unanimously on September 21st at a special meeting. We did receive thorough questions from our Parks Commissioners as well as some public input in the month of August when it was open during that public comment period. However, we do believe the plan is ready, that it has been thoroughly vetted by our community with over 2,400 public comments coming into it through surveys and other means. The implications for holding it or passing it are somewhat minor, other than we're kind of ready to close this chapter in our work and get to start implementing it and moving it forward. So there is nothing hinging on this right now in this moment, other than I think our belief that is a well-compiled document that does represent the wishes and cares of our community.
Thank you.
And disposed. I'm not sure if she had a question still or not. Councillors, any other questions? You okay? Good. If not, I believe we're done. You may have a seat.
Yep.
All right. That is the end of our agenda. I believe we're going to take a couple minutes of personal privilege, and then we'll have our public safety committee meeting. Good. Thank you. Oh, we'll come back at, is it 8 after. Oh. 5 minutes. Not even all at the same time, no. It'll be 8 after. Oh,
just when the time comes out, it's in the new system.
Okay, let me get out of the way.
When somebody presses a button, it changes.
A number will come up, like which order they And I have finger happy.
You do the council.
I usually do the council, but
and then he does others.
He does others, but he knows that I get a little like doing my thing, you know, push it, and I'm like, oh, that's right. But yes.
Okay, it'll work. Councilors, if we could take our seats, please. Good evening. I forgot what it's like to sit in this seat. It's been several years. I know. I'm like, ooh, I like it. So, councilors, I am very, very grateful and excited tonight to welcome Chief Grigier and Courtney Buchholz from HDC. Courtney and the chief have been working with their staffs for I don't know how long, months and months and months, on the creation and implementation of a community crisis response team. And I'm really excited to hear from them tonight about the progress that is being made for the well-being of our community and how this is all working for HDC and Chief Grigier and the fire staff. So I will turn it over to you all.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and councilors. Again, I'm Sean Grigier, I'm the fire chief. And I'm primarily the primary point of contact for the city of Duluth with the crisis prevention team. One of the questions that had come up already even tonight was, this seems like this should be more like a police responsibility, law enforcement. And let me just say that part of this, and for the councilors who had the history and went through this last year, it was intentional that it was left out of the law enforcement side. And put on to a responsibility was asked of me to be that primary liaison and primary point of contact. It was something that the citizens and the community really wanted, was an alternative response to 911, not having to call for a police response for things that were not criminal. And they fall into several different categories, and I'll let Courtney dive into that in more depth. But that's kind of what I do. I also liaison with some of the other community partners, which might be St. Louis County, dispatch, primarily how they get called, how they get dispatched, how we work through some of the other things. And then I, of course, work with our finance department, primarily budget manager Casper, to allocate this funding appropriately to HDC. So I'm going to let Courtney introduce herself.
My name is Courtney Buchholz, and I am a crisis responder, first of all, and then I'm also the community coordinator for the HDC program. I work with Sean pretty closely with the Community Advisory Council as well. Oh, it's all me. All right. Here we go. So we had a crisis program in Duluth. We've had one for several years. The problem was is that it wasn't quite as robust of a program as the community wanted to see. So there was petitioning for Duluth City funds, which thankfully we received because we were able to grow the program quite a bit. HDC took over the mobile crisis response part of the program December 7th of last year, and a few months later, we received the crisis funding. Okay, you can do the next slide. I don't like funding, so Sean's going to help with this part, but the first part of our funding is for that mobile crisis grant. That's through Arrowhead Behavioral Health Initiative, or ABHI, and like I said, that funds the mobile crisis part, crisis therapy, and then rapid access psychiatry, which I'll talk about more later. Then we have the Duluth City Grant Funds, and that funds the rest, which we'll get into. But first, I'm going to let Sean explain the next slide.
Chair Anderson, councilors, this is the budget, the proposed budget that you voted on last year. I thought that was important for the new councilors to see the breakdown, how that was actually supposed to be allocated. We're sticking still to that plan, but of course there are a few things with primarily the equipment. So I think like the vehicle costs went up due to COVID for both the fact that there was a supply shortage and just the costs went up. So there were some things. One thing that was built into this budget was approximately $100,000 cushion. If you look at things like vehicles and laptops, stuff like that, those were extrapolated out for the whole three-year budget cycle. Well, we're not actually buying vehicles every year for 3 years. We're not buying laptops every year for 3 years, things like that. So there was some built-in cushion into that budget already. We are on track with this. We had a little bit of a slow start due to some hiring, I guess, complications, just like any other organization or company or job market. We had people, we had a hard time actually recruiting enough people. They were actually responding since January. They just weren't at full staff yet. And so some of the full capabilities that we're seeing now and getting into now as we move forward, we're a little bit slow to start. But they do actually report back to us quarterly. So currently, we obviously just finished the third quarter last week. So we haven't reimbursed that yet, but we do have reimbursements for the first and second quarter. And we are on track with that current budget spending. Next slide.
Okay, so now it's the fun part. We're going to talk about some of the things that we're able to do. Mobile crisis is, to be honest, it's kind of the thing that we've had the longest. The new 988 number that everybody's talking about, good or bad, however people feel, that is what gets people to the first call for help, mental health dispatch center. When someone calls that, they are either, it's called warm-lined, just kind of talk to, or they get transferred to us and one of us are talk to them or are sent out to help with them. Like the name says, it's mobile. So we have gone to Burger King, Motel 6, Starbucks, Holiday. We've done assessments outside of CHUM, in assisted livings, nursing homes, grade schools, high schools, middle schools, the colleges. We've gone all over the place. If a person doesn't have a home and just really needs to talk and get some help, we'll put them in the car and go for a drive with them. It can include things like getting an abused woman to a shelter, taking someone, like I said, to CHUM, taking them out to, up to Damiano to get them some food. Whatever their need is, we try to meet that. It also involves crisis therapy. Right now, getting someone in to talk to a therapist can take several weeks. We are able to get someone in within 24 hours to one of our crisis therapists. It's been really helpful. It helps to kind of fill that gap so that maybe they don't go back into their crisis in the meantime. Psychiatry is even harder to get into. It's often a wait of 6 months at this point. And so we're able to use this funding to help get people in really quickly to rapid access psychiatry, usually within 24 to 72 hours. Through the City of Duluth funding in particular, we've been able to do a lot with outreach. That included the first time we really experienced it was with the Berry family tragedy. We went over there and just reached out, did a ton of outreach to the surrounding community. We also worked with the homeschool groups that they were a part of. A lot of the kids were just really experiencing a lot of stress and crisis surrounding that, so we were able to help out a lot there. We have also gone to skywalks under the overpasses. We've gone all over with this, with the outreach funding, providing some, you know, just some food and just kind of crisis prevention type of work. One of the most important things with the funding has been the mental health welfare checks. Before we were able to do mental health welfare checks, before the City of Duluth funding, we were really limited. The person had to be voluntary. They had to want us there. We had to talk to them first. Otherwise, we were unable to respond. The welfare, because of the way the grant was stipulated. With this, it's been amazing because we've had practitioners call us, we've had dads call us from California, we've had people from all over call and say, look, we've really got a problem with my son, or I saw this person on the street yelling, what can you do? And instead of having to direct them to call 911, we're able to go out and help out with that. That's been, to me, one of the most exciting things. We've also worked with the library to have an embedded library responder. If you guys have been outside of there lately, you'll know that it's kind of looking a little more like the CHUM sometimes. A lot of needs are based around the library. There's internet bathrooms. They were seeing a lot of overdoses, 2 to 3 police responses per day, and just a lot of problems. And obviously, librarians didn't get into it for social work. They don't know for sure what to do, and it's very stressful for them, even though they've been trying to manage the best that they can. Thankfully, we have been able to send a crisis responder over there from 2 till 5 or 2 till 8, 5 days a week. They also have our crisis outreach number so that we can show up if they have a situation that they are uncomfortable dealing with. We're also starting to work with Parks and Rec to see if there are ways that we can kind of help them with some of the issues that they've been having. And finally, the grant paid for a registered new nurse, which has been really helpful. She's actually embedded on the core team, and it's been great because we've been able to work with her to try to get people help outside of law enforcement, which has been really helpful. Okay, next slide. And then me. As the community coordinator, we've been able to do a lot with that as well. I do a lot of community education. I've spoken with Stepping On Up.
offering a lot of information around mental illness, substance use, and just that stigma that surrounds all of that, including homelessness. We do something called mental health first aid training. So I'm able to go into different communities, businesses, whoever wants the training. It's an 8-hour training that we offer for just the cost of materials. And we go in and talk about mental illness and specifically crisis and de-escalation. And then just really trying to increase the visibility of our program, because that's going to help with people's usage of the program, as well as when we're hiring and trying to get more people on board. Because we started with 3, and there were 3 of us for like 6 months, and it was wonderful and horrible all at once because we were still getting a ton of calls. We've grown, I think we're at 9 right now, which has been great, but we are still getting a really high volume of calls. So eventually, you know, we're hoping to get up to 12 at least. Okay, next slide. And then the Community Advisory Council. Sean, yes.
Very last thing you stated.
Oh, responders. Yeah, no problem. All right, and then we have the Community Advisory Council. Do you want to talk about why that was started? Yeah.
Two things. This was started as a grassroots effort from several different community groups, community organizers, Democratic Socialists of America, the NAACP, and several others that started this petition to city administration and city council, both for funding and just for some other option, a different response besides law enforcement. So the Community Advisory Council, as we move forward, is still made up of members of different parts of the community, and I'll let Courtney break that down a little further. But the intent of that is to make sure that we're still focused on what the community expects, what those expectations are, and to make sure that the program is delivering what they want for their money. One of the highlights, I think, one of the main highlights, as Courtney mentioned earlier, were those welfare checks. Currently, this Duluth program, HDC staff, they're the only ones that are doing those wellness checks in this, at least in this area or this region. So if someone calls 988, that call center is actually based out of Grand Rapids area. And then they dispatch the appropriate place, wherever. So in this case, Duluth, we're the only ones that do those welfare checks. Other places, they're being told, we don't do that. That's not a service we provide. So it's more than just the response. It's more than just someone in a crisis having a response. What they're doing is actually preventing the crisis before it happens. And I think that's something that the community really emphasized, really wanted, and one of the big follow-throughs, both from HDC and just the program as a whole.
Yeah, so as part of our Community Advisory Council, we have a couple of community organizers, a social worker, a lawyer, the RN from CERT, a therapist from Lake Superior Medical Clinic, tons of them with experience, both lived. Some of them have experience because of their children, and then people in the community that are working in this role already. It's been really great because every time we come together, we really get a lot done. And then we're also trying to ensure that we have the best crisis program, you know, hopefully in the nation, but in just in the state. We just want it to be what Duluth wants, which is why we're trying to do initiatives like going to the library, working with Parks and Rec, whatever it is. We want to use our funding and our staff to try to prevent crisis and just, you know, destigmatize mental health a little bit. Okay, so I'm just going to share 2 stories because I think that that's kind of the most important part. My first day in crisis, I was actually called by my coworker the night before, and she said, you should quit, man. We had a really rough day because we had had all this training, and then crisis actually hit, and we were like, oh my goodness, this is a lot. You know, it's one thing to talk about, it's another thing to experience it. So I got to work, and we ended up going out in the afternoon to see a gentleman we'll call Ronald. He was out on the West End. And he invited us to his hotel room, which we declined. So we talked him into going to Burger King with us instead. While we were there, he became very animated. It was obvious that substance use was involved, and he ended up standing up, pulling a knife. And it was kind of like a moment you sit back and you're like, oh boy, what next? You know, because like I said, we're at Burger King and you don't want to die there. So it wasn't good. So I told him, I said, hey, I don't want to die like hungry and chubby in Burger King. It's not my thing. And he started laughing, put his knife away, eventually offered to buy me some food and coffee. And while he was doing that, we made a safety plan to just kind of get him out of there. So we said, hey, it's getting dark. We need to leave. And he goes, you know, there are a lot of weirdos in the area. Let me help get you out of here. So he did. He walked us to our car, and he was very, you know, very kind about it, but obviously very troubled. We made it back to the office. We did call Duluth police because it was obvious that he really needed some help. I went back with an officer, and at that time we found out that he had a gun in the hotel room. So I safety planned from outside of the door, and we left him, and he was okay for the evening. The next morning, he called back, and he wanted me to come out to meet with him. I did, and on the way I called law enforcement. I said, "Can you just kind of be nearby? Because, you know, last night maybe wasn't the greatest experience, so I just want to make sure we're safe as well." So he parked nearby, and I went out and met with the gentleman. It was a couple of hours that I sat talking to him, and eventually was able to convince him that he needed to go to the emergency, or he needed to talk to the police, that we had a really nice officer and all these things. The officer came in, he was excellent, and when it was time to bring him to the emergency room, he flat out refused to ride with the cop. So I took him in the car, off we went to the emergency room. Unfortunately, when we got there, they had called every security guard and everything else. So we pulled into the parking garage and whoosh, all there they were. This obviously did not go well for Ronald. He was not very happy about it. He was yelling. I calmed him down again. We got out of the car. I said, "Look, I'll stay with you the whole time." So I did. I held his hand. He is just this big man. I mean, he's like 6'6". I mean, he was huge, just a big guy. And we go walking in, and he's posturing. He's just making himself as big as possible. But as he's holding my hand, he's just trembling. He was so scared. So I held his hand into the emergency room. We got into a room, and it was very difficult. There were several security officers. Law enforcement was there, a male physician, a male nurse, and everyone was really escalated. I was able to stay in the room with him the whole time. At one point, he, like I said, he became escalated again. He jumped up off the bed, and I was able to put a hand on him, calm him down. They told him they were going to take his clothes off and put a gown on him. If that meant they had to use force, they would. He was, of course, not going with that. So I put a song on that he liked on my phone. I held it up to his ear, and I said, "How about if I undress you and get your clothes? You know, I'll put the hospital gown on." So he was okay with that. We did it. I held his hand as they sedated him, because he really needed that kind of help. And he laid there eating his peanut butter sandwich and fell asleep. And I was able to leave him peacefully. And I've never heard anything about him again. The second story I wanted to share was, I was working crisis. I was about a month in, and I got a call from one of the officers, and he said they had had a call to from a mother who said she had poisoned her 3 children. Come to find out, she had not. She was in a meth-induced psychosis. So he wanted me to come out there because he didn't know what to do with these kids. He didn't know how to help her. So I went out. In the meantime, the poor man was trying to make them eggs because the kids hadn't eaten for quite a while, and he couldn't find a clean pan. So I picked up some food, got to the house, set the kids up with food, and went and talked to the mom. She was just, it was pretty vacant look on her eyes, but I was able to convince her to go with law enforcement to the emergency room, and I stayed with the kids. I called in a backup staff, and we stayed there for about 5 hours. We cleaned the house. We, you know, cleared out the fridge. We tried to get a hold of their family. We tried to get a hold of CPS. We tried several avenues to get these kids help, but we wanted to keep them in their home as long as we could so that the right people could be brought into play. The plan, I think, was to bring them to, is it Bethel? Yeah, I believe that's where we were supposed to bring them, but we wanted to keep them in the home if we could, because we didn't need to add another layer of stress to them. As we worked with them, the oldest daughter was very standoffish. Sat in the stairwell and kind of gave us, you know, the glare pretty much the whole time. As we worked with the other 2 children, and they were engaged and having fun, and we started playing games, the oldest daughter started coming down slowly. Still wouldn't talk to us, wouldn't have anything to do with us. And she ended up standing by a huge curio cabinet. They obviously didn't have much. They had like 4 to 7 things in this huge cabinet. And she just stood there looking at everything. And I went and stood by her, and I didn't say anything. And she said, "You know, she's not always like this." And I just said, "Yeah, I know." And I left it at that. And she said, she's not always like this. And like I said, I just said, "I know." And I left it. The thing that is the most, I think the thing I remember about the story the most was that daughter. She just wanted someone to know that that was not the totality of who her mom was. That was not the end-all, be-all of who her mom was, what the police saw, what I was seeing. This was not the fullness of her story. And I think that it's really important to remember that, because as we work in crisis, we see people at their worst, in their darkest, and whatever. And what we want is to offer them light and to remind them that this is not the totality of your story. So we have no idea what people are going through. These are two stories, and I could be here all night talking about more. A mom and dad struggling to cope with their daughter's mental illness, trying to keep her alive long enough to get help. A guy in his 20s naked outside of HDC calling my name because he thinks I'm the only person in his life that cares. A woman trafficked from the ages of 7 to 30, started on meth at the age of 7 because she couldn't handle what was happening to her body, and now she's just trying to survive. And a mom with two daughters, both struggling with addiction, one roaming the streets, the other daughter was in treatment with an infant, and she said, tell me which one's going to die first, because it had better be me. I can't take losing either one of them. We have story after story here in this community of brokenness, pain, and a lot of hurt humanity. In closing, I just really wanted to thank you guys for everything that this grant money has brought us. The fact that we were able to go and work with this guy over the course of 2 days to be able to soften some of the blow that mental health and substance use can bring has really been a blessing to me. Working with this mom and being able to just bring her kids food and clean for 5 hours and do those things wouldn't be possible for the police. They don't have time for that type of thing, and we're just really blessed that we do. So that's the end. We have questions. You can answer. Ask them.
Thank you, Courtney and Chief Berger. This is an amazing thing to hear these stories and just to get a sense of how things are going for you all. We have some questions lined up. Councilor Awal, I believe you are first.
Thank you so much. This was something that was I was really passionate about and got involved in other community ways. And I'm just really excited that, to the extent it's come, how it's serving our community. I thank you, Chair Anderson, and thank you for the presentation and the stories. Having worked in crisis myself, it's a lot, and there's a lot of emotional labor too that we don't recognize that crisis responders take on. So I guess my question is, how can the city continue to support in a way that we are preventing burnout from the HDC staff who are the crisis responders?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, I think a lot of it has to come down to staffing. We are currently at 9. We would like to go to 12, possibly 15. The reasoning is that UMD is actually going, and as well as the other colleges, they're going to be using us for their evening, overnight, early morning crisis. We think there will be an influx of overnight calls, roughly around 250. And because of that, we staff with on-call on overnight. And if you can imagine getting that many calls, even spread out over those terms, it's still going to really increase our call volume by quite a bit. We would like to eventually have more evening and late night overnight staff to be able to respond to that, because that's going to really decrease our burnout. I know that at first I was working just really a lot of crazy hours, and I loved it. And then I started to feel it a little bit. And so I appreciate that being concerned about our burnout. HDC has been great. We've been able to take time off whenever we needed it. If we needed a personal day to just kind of decompress a little bit after crazy days. Like I said, I really think that staffing and ensuring that we're able to fully staff would be the most helpful, because it sometimes we'll get, you know, 8 calls back to back, and if you have 2 responders, we have to section those out. So having more responders would be really great.
A follow-up to that, are there positions that are part-time or voluntary positions available for community to get involved with, and maybe not at the full crisis responder level, but at other levels? And the second question is, are you in contact with community partners, essentially, like community partners with, I know there's a lot of great nonprofits, PAVSA, the the We Health Clinic. Where is the communication with community partners, and how are you working together to alleviate this burden of, you know, supporting our constituents during crisis?
So the first question, actually, I'll answer the second first. So I personally have reached out. We've worked with ACO, PAVSA. We work really closely. Oh, one thing I didn't mention was that we're also doing the emergency department case management for St. Luke's and Essentia, because we saw a ton of people falling through the cracks. We would bring them, drop them off, and they would kind of get, you know, released back out, and we're able to kind of fill that gap. So we are able to work really closely with these, with all the different partners. PAVSA is going to be doing some cross training for us. I'll be doing crisis training for them. They're going to be coming in and doing training for us. The same goes with Leanne Littlewolf from ACO, who is actually on our advisory council. She is going to be doing some training on indigenous kind of crisis response. And so we're going to be doing cross training in that way as well, which will be really helpful. It helps with our staff. They love education. And we are also working with the police. We've done some training out there. I did it personally. We have two more going out this next week for de-escalation, live de-escalation training. So that's been really great. And what was your first question?
With the staffing issue, are there part-time or volunteer staffing positions available for community members?
Yes, correct. So we do have, I think we have 4 part-time staff at this time, and there are more opportunities for that as well. As far as volunteers go, when I've been speaking with the Stepping On Up program, people have been you know, really asking about that. So we're trying to put together some kind of program. We've had several registered nurses that are really interested. Our program hasn't fully developed the medical side. We haven't needed it so far. We've needed more of the therapy and psychiatry. But there are people that are really interested, and we're trying to develop those pieces as we go. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Shuckman, please.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I just wanted to take a quick moment to thank Ms. Buchholz and Chief Crugier and HTC for their work on this. Councilor Anderson, you and I spent a lot of time on this last year. And for me, it's really gratifying to see that work come to fruition and to see that it is being successful and having an impact. Chief Crugier, in particular, from the administration standpoint, I think would likely acknowledge that this was not something he expected to spend time on his career, but has done so with enthusiasm and has been really jumped right into it and done a great job from the administration standpoint. So I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that. Thank him. Thank Ms. Buchholz and HGC for the great work. Starting something like this is not easy, and we, you know, that we worked with them to some extent, but it is something they've had to do, and I just think it deserves a great deal of credit. So thank you for the opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Shuckman. Vice President Kennedy.
Thank you, Councillor. Chair Anderson, I have a couple of questions, but I may have to pause and let somebody else go after in the middle. The first one would be is, you had mentioned that there may be some overnight work that you'll be doing with UMD, and I'm not sure if you mentioned other organizations. Are they paying for that fee, or is that time going to be, are you taking that funding to pay for your staff out of what you have already? Because it sounds like it's an extra sort of strategy, so I would hope that we would have the expectation that we would receive some funding for that. Because I believe this is funded through ARP money, and there's not really a dedicated, no, we do have a dedicated fund, don't we? Yeah. I'm still a little bit worried, though, if you're adding some other services, you know, how are those being paid?
So that we're not adding extra services for UMD. This University of Minnesota, this is their policy, you know, in Minneapolis up here. It's that the students are off. So the students during the day, they have a lot of access to the therapists that are there and everything. They've been having problems on overnights, which is kind of where we come in. Last year, we were used roughly 40 times by Duluth UMD students because they don't necessarily always want to call UMD staff or let their instructor, their counselor, their RA know what's going on. So they, just like any community member, would utilize our service. Just like an assisted living, a nursing home, they have clients that are called have called our services for assistance.
I will follow up with that. So it sounds like the services are increasing as far as the demand.
Correct.
How do we, or how do you, how does the city propose to pay for that? Because we have a dedicated funding, right? And we have a dedicated amount of hours, a dedicated amount of time. And if the services needed increase, how are we going to pay for that? I don't believe the city should be moving forward to invest more into this type of work. I'm wondering if there's other partners. Again, I ask for, is there a fee for service when we're looking at these places that you're going to a lot of the time? Have we considered that? That may be a question for you and staff.
So we do write for other grant funding and sources for revenue. However, like I said, I mean, with UMD students, any student that we work with, any geriatric population, whatever it is, we go to wherever they are. So we wouldn't charge UMD for service for that. At least we haven't so far. We are writing for other grant funding from the state. So, you know, there is, I'm not here petitioning for more money. I'm just letting you know what we have done so far and the work that we've done and why it is so exciting. So.
Staff, do you have any thoughts on that? And then I'm going to pause and let others. Chair Anderson.
Chair Anderson, Vice President Kennedy, you know, the dedicated funding that the council and administration agreed on last year is the current scope of financial capability that the city has. If the city were to fund it further, then we would need to be talking about a levy increase to do that, just like we did last year to establish the program.
Chair Anderson, Vice President Kennedy, we also work with St. Louis County. You know, Health and Human Services is in general a county, falls under their purview, under their jurisdiction. They've got a similar program to this that's based out of Range Healthcare, Range Mental Healthcare, out of Virginia. So there's opportunities potentially there if we expand this program countywide that there would be some support here. I sit on another committee that works with that larger group as well. I think as far as the numbers going up, that's what we had hoped. That's what we expected. We literally recreated the wheel. This is brand new. We had zero calls last year. A majority of their calls that they go on now would have went to 911. You would have had a police, fire, and ambulance response, just like any other medical call. Those are now being diverted to this program. How do we expand that? That's a great question. I know they have leveraged the funding they have now to looking for other grant money. Public partnerships, of course, that's something. I know we looked at a grant a few years ago for the fire department to through the Northland Foundation, I believe it was, and also another one through the Miller-Dwan Foundation. That was to kind of cover that medical side, Courtney Express. So when you've heard about the CAHOOTS model several times. There's a lot of co-responder models where there's a social worker or a mental health professional going with a paramedic or a firefighter or something to potentially deal with that medical side. We hadn't pursued that as of right now because, again, we needed to start somewhere, and this was a good first start. If it expands, those are questions we'll all have to deal with.
Councilor Mayo, please.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Just a couple of questions. And first off, thank you so much for being here and presenting. I thought the stories were really the most impactful part about hearing what this work really truly means to the people in the community. First, I just wanted to reiterate, it's 988. That's the number, right? Okay. Because, yeah, there's go ahead.
there's an issue. So 988... is nationwide, right? Tons of places aren't ready for that. So you might see there was an article that NPR did. There have been some postings on Facebook, which is super fun to explain to people, and saying that I called 988 and the police showed up. This is, you know, a terrible thing. That's because a lot of places aren't ready for it, which is why it's not a huge rollout. We're not playing it up a ton. The reasoning is because they aren't ready for it, but we are. When people call 988, we're completely ready to show up for those calls to help in any way possible. There's another piece And that is better explained by Sean. Essentially, if you are not from this area, say we have a student at UMD from California, and they call, their call goes back out to California, which is a problem. So we have two numbers that are on all of our cards. It's on all of our marketing materials. It's that 988 number, and then it's the original number, which is the 844-772-something. That is the other number that's on there, because that is the local number. Both of them go to the same place to first call for help.
Yeah, correct. As far as that second part, Chair Anderson, Councilor Mayo, there's a problem nationwide. Normally, like if you call 911, the way they geolocate your phone call through the cell towers or through your landline, they know that you're calling from Duluth. Sometimes there's a little, on a border state like this, you might get something that runs through Douglas County and they quickly transfer it over to the PSAP here in St. Louis County. For some reason, when they set this up nationwide, so this is not a Duluth issue, this is a nationwide issue. If you have a prefix from Oregon, South Carolina, wherever, it routes that call back to that place. And the same for Minnesota. So if someone from Duluth, 218, is in New Jersey, and they call this 988 number, it'll reroute back to Grand Rapids. So that's a problem that they're trying to fix. I sit on a regional radio board. We're working on that through that kind of that state level legislation, but it's actually certainly bigger than Duluth, bigger than Minnesota, and it's a big problem. I can't explain to you why it's set up that way, but it's not a good way. That's all I can tell you.
Thank you. I didn't realize, yeah, it was that much of a problem, actually. yeah, I was just wanting to reiterate the number, but I didn't know there was more behind that. Is that operated 24/7 then? You can call that any time of day. And then you had mentioned a warm line when you answer that call. Is that just like a standard 911 operator would be able to talk with that person and continue a conversation a little bit longer, maybe?
So we've had people have called first call for help and been on the phone with them for an hour, sometimes more. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because they just need someone to listen to them, to hear them out, maybe to plan with them a little bit in a different way. It might be somebody that's already in a safe environment. They might be in a group home. They just need to kind of talk through some altercation that happened at the home or whatever. But that's what the warm lining is, essentially. We also get calls that the person maybe does need to go immediately to the emergency room. First call for help will tell them that, and then we'll either get called to take them, or say it's a child, the parent will take them, and then we will go to the emergency room to meet them there to try to connect.
Okay, thank you. And then on that kind of note with the number and triaging and all of that, does 911 ever triage to you? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yep. That's the new thing. July, that happened in July. He's the backup because I forget dates. But in July, that's when that started happening. So they have a whole system, and when it's a mental health welfare check, they make sure it's safe and everything. Then they transfer that to first call for help, and we get sent out. We also have an outreach number that has been given to the DPD, and they will also call us quite frequently to say, "Hey, we just found this person out on the sidewalk. We think it's safe. Can you guys head over there because, maybe they don't want police presence?" And that's been really, really helpful.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
And Chair Anderson, Councilor Mayo, we also have the ability to refer HDC, the crisis team, after what comes in potentially as a medical call. So maybe someone's having difficulty breathing. So that actually comes in as a medical call, legitimate medical call. We get there, we find out they're having difficulty breathing because they have anxiety, because they have this, whatever their mental health issue is or whatever their crisis might be. So at that point, we would still then call for a mental health or crisis response or give them that information to call next time, depending on where it is. It might be a medical issue that actually needs to be treated and seen in a hospital, but we have that ability also to change it from a 911 response partway through if we deem that that's the appropriate response level that they need.
That makes a lot of sense. And then, if I may, Chair Anderson, or
I want to say we're okay. Already sort of over the time that we actually originally saw. So I want to go to Councilor Randolph, if we may, and then we'll see how we go.
Councilor Randolph, please. Thank you so much, Chair Anderson. Thank you for the work you do, Manager Buckles, Chief Crugier. My question is I field a lot of questions and concerns on encampments. Three this week. One was over on 4th and 5th West. 4th and 5th Avenues West, another one was 210 North 13th. I understand you guys go out with Deb Holman at times, Life Safety does, to look at these encampments, make decisions on what we can do, provide services when you can. It feels like to me right now, it's the problem is like almost growing a little bit. What are you guys seeing, and how is this funding in your in this crisis intervention plan helping this?
Chair Anderson, Councilor Randorf, we actually brought HDC into that encampment enforcement probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Does that sound about right? About a month ago. As you said, we, Life Safety, police, and then the community, CHOM, Deb Holman from CHOM and Joe Kilgore and some other partners go to these sites. If we find that they need to be disbanded, we placard them, we give them the appropriate time. We noticed that this was a need, and so we invited Courtney and her team, if they're available. Again, now, one of the problems is we've seen such success with this program in such a short time. We've already expanded it to having staff at the library, staff going out to homeless encampment enforcement. So they're still, their priority is still crisis response. So if someone calls that 988 number, they need to respond to that person. They may or may not be available to go to homeless encampment enforcement. But that's that big piece that we're looking for, is that prevention piece, heading these off, getting people the resources they need ahead of time. And I know you've got some data on how many times it takes, like 20 times or something like that, offering help before someone actually accepts that help. So the relationships that they're building in that piece is not only helping us to get out of that lack of enforcement or lessing enforcement, and then actually getting people the help they needed. I'll let you expand on that, but we brought them into it about a month ago.
So, you know, what we do are the mental health welfare check piece of it. Deb and John work really closely with Parks and Rec. I met with them a couple weeks ago with Parks and Rec specifically, just to talk about what is a mental health crisis and where can we be utilized. As you can imagine, losing your home, be it a tent or whatever, is crisis inducing. So during those times, the Parks and Rec Department has our outreach number, which is the part of the program that I kind of run. And then they also have my direct number, and John and Deb utilize us frequently. So if they go out to a place and they know, like, hey, this person's really going to have a hard time, they'll call us for some crisis prevention. If the person is being told to move and they've moved and it's really not going well, that's another time that they'll utilize us. So they have in the past a little bit, but this is kind of... I guess more people are going to know about the program, right, as we go through Parks and Rec. So I think it'll really grow our opportunity to be able to do some pre-crisis work to hopefully prevent some things from happening.
We have a couple of counselors who have additional questions, and I want to just say that we're really pushing time for staff and everybody. If I may, I'm going to take a quick minute here and just say, I'm like so impressed and so grateful. It was, you know, over the last year, President Forsman, counselor, former counselor Medved, our colleague, Vice President at that time, Vanette, and myself worked really hard with city staff to and come up with a plan to create this thing. And I'm like, I'm just so proud. I'm just beyond the beyond. And I just see that the impact that this program is having already. And I just want to say for council who are here, administration, Chief Grigier, Courtney, that I really want to look at how we want to look for the long term, you know, to make sure that when the need is really there, when we're prepared, like, so that we can get you from 9 staff to 12 staff, and whether maybe there's ultimately there becomes a new agency, who knows? We together are creating the Duluth model here, you know, and I feel, you know, a year ago we were all, you know, ranting and raving about the cahoots, and the community was talking so much about the cahoots model, but I don't think that that's really happening anymore. I do want to share this, and I'll try to brief. So this comes from Jamie Sharp, who is the NAACP and has worked with Lean and who has been really pushed us as a community and pushed you all. I know is in direct relationship, but he just said, wants to send a clear message of support to HDC, Chief Brzee, and other community members that are taking the lead on the Community Advisory Council. We have additionally had the opportunity to see members of the crisis team at work throughout the city. At our decriminalized color event alone a few weeks ago, the crisis team helped navigate and de-escalate two separate situations that previously could have led to a 911 call and police contact. So it's right there. This team, he's talking about the HDC team, is a huge part of the answer to the increased strain on our 911 system and the emergency department. He just goes on and on and on that this is the right time, the right team, the right leadership, and the right community. So I really want to just affirm and the right community buy-in for a change in our community safety system that can make meaningful change for years to come. Was to encourage the city to really look at increasing sustainable funding for the crisis response team. So he says we need crisis team members available 24/7. So, you know, and as here, you know, we are, when we think about police, fire, and ambulance, you know, this new team, you know, working in, with a corps and other people, but is really taking a burden off and allowing the fire department to do what they do best, allowing the police department to do what they do best, allowing ambulance to do what they do best. And we have to look at if this leaving burden for all these other agencies, then how do we shift funding? How do we shift priority and public awareness? And finally, I'll just say I'm sort of disappointed that Peter didn't stay here from the, you know, that there's not other media here to hear this, but perhaps it's for the good, you know, that they're still building this core and building capacity and agency. So I have a whole ton of questions, but I'll take them up. And I'm going to go to Vice President Kennedy.
I'm done. There we go.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I just have a couple of questions. I would like to see sort of the agreement that was set up before, because I know when it was first set up, I had some questions as far as how we were being equitable and making sure we're going across the city. So my question would be is, could you give me some numbers of where you've been in the Lincoln Park area? I've heard a lot of downtown UMD or in the Western Duluth area or out to far west. And is this the model that you thought we'd be doing and the population that we'd be that you would be serving?
Let me try to remember. So we have shown up to every area of the city. Every time we've gotten a call, we've never turned someone down. Every time First Call for Help has called us, no matter where it is, you know, in the city, we've gone out to Lincoln Park area. We've gone way out to Gary, New Duluth. We've been all over East End, you know, just we've been all over the place with this. Like I said, we've never turned someone down. As the crisis program grows and people find out that we are there for them, that we're person-centered, that we attempt not to use law enforcement, all of those things, I think that will grow the number of people that call us as well. We don't have the numbers here with us because it is so early in the program. So the mobile crisis part was December 7th, but this part of the program rolled out in full roughly in like May, June. Yeah, probably June. So we just don't have the numbers that we need because, like I said, we were building staffing at this time. Just as a side note, the CAHOOTS program, when they hire new people and onboard, they train for 6 months. We trained for 1 month, no fault of HDC's. We're just trying to roll out this program. There were three of us, and we're quickly trying to hire new staff and train people in and everything and grow this program all at once. So we weren't marketing to the highest level at that time. I've been working with Chris Demilke, who is our marketing person. We've been doing a ton of things to market this program so that we've shown up to tons of schools, West End, Lincoln Park, East End, all over the place to try to talk to kids and their parents about the program. We're really trying with that, but we were limited in marketing at first because of the limited staff that we had. So, you know, as much as we'd want to roll the program out really fast and have people know about it right away and whatever. We just weren't able to. Now that people are finding out more and more and they see what we can do specifically with Jamie Sharp's, the instances that happened there, when people see what we're able to do and that we're able to take time and, you know, hopefully have some prevention of law enforcement showing up in those things, I think we're going to be more heavily utilized in every area of the city.
Chair Anderson, Vice President Kennedy, it's our intent to have an annual review report out to you. We would like to have more of those numbers. Again, some of these things, they're so new. The 988 first call for help has been around, but that 988 just started July 16th. We have numbers for their response before they were fully going, but some of that stuff, we actually had to work with St. Louis County, how we've never kept this data before because we've never responded like this before. So there's going to be probably some lower numbers that you might see this year than next year. And again, it's just because it's so new. We've found some gaps. The community was asking for some numbers of things that we weren't tracking. So I worked with St. Louis County Dispatch, and now they've changed how they track some of this data. So we'll start having that. Those numbers coming in. So just I really want to emphasize that this is a successful program. Those stories, although they're tragic and there's tragedy in the stories, they're actually stories of success. So please give us a little bit of patience and time to develop it, and then we will have better data moving forward.
Just real quickly, I do appreciate the work you're doing, and I just want to make sure that, because when we first started having this conversation, wanted to make sure it's across the city. That's all.
Thank you, Vice President Kennedy. Councilors, I want to thank you all for your energy and time and awareness, and I hope that you all will follow up with questions to me, to Chief Grigier, to Courtney, as we go forward. And I'm just, again, really grateful to both of you for your good work and the teamwork, and to how we're all making a difference in this community. So thank you. I think we will adjourn this public safety meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.